Good afternoon and welcome to our latest Tenneo Insights webinar with the Secretary of State for Digital, Culture, Media and Sport, Oliver Dowden, and some highly influential figures in the sectors he oversees. Not so long ago, DCMS was considered a sleepy backwater of government. The annoying bigwigs at Number 10 often ignored it and were happy to take responsibility for the few things in the department they considered important. Not anymore. In the last 15 months since coronavirus took hold, the department has been front and centre in the public debate, suddenly responsible for things tens of millions of people care about and were under real threats, such as spectator sports, the production of TV and programmes and films, and town centres where theatres and cinemas were crucial to attracting people. On top of that, the more bread and butter issues have become more contentious in the last year. What will the online harms bill really mean for the tech industry? Will there be a ban on advertising on foods that are high in fat, sugar and salt? And what's going to happen to the gambling industry that hasn't seen a major shift in regulation since the internet really took hold? Finally, the old idea that countries have a single culture, which we can all get behind, has been blown out of the window. Increasingly, there are at least two tribes with vastly different attitudes on everything from statues to how often and proudly the Union Jack flag can be displayed. Can culture still unify? Joining the Secretary of State to discuss all of this are Alex Mann, the CEO of Channel 4, the acclaimed and award-winning playwright and screenwriter James Graham, and Dawn Airey, who after an illustrious TV career is now the chair of the FA's Women's Super League and Women's Championship Football, as well as chair of the National Youth Theatre. Before we get to the panel, the usual housekeeping points. Please keep yourself on mute throughout the call. If you have a question, please drop it in the chat function at the side of the screen, and I'll put it to the panel in the second half of the call. And if you're a journalist, please drop off now. This isn't intended for republication or further broadcast. Oliver, let's start with you. It's been quite a year. Give us a few minutes on where you think we are coming out of lockdown, what we've learned and what we need to watch out for going forward.
Well, thank you, Craig, and thank you for inviting me to this. And it's great to see James, Dawn and Alex on this panel as well, all of whom have been involved very closely in the events of the past year or so that I've been Culture Secretary. I think I count now as a veteran Culture Secretary because I've been in post for almost 17 months. I think I've just overtaken John Whittingdale and certainly a lot longer than others. So if I achieve nothing else, I've got a bit of a longevity in the role. And James, thank you for all that you've done in terms of shaping the Cultural Recovery Fund and Dawn, all you've been doing in relation to football in particular and serving on the fan-led review. And Alex, we have had numerous discussions as we've seen how broadcasting has adapted during this COVID crisis. And I think, Craig, you're absolutely right what you said at the beginning. Well, slightly correct. I do remember when I was in Number 10, I think this was probably before you joined, DCMS shot to prominence for me during the Leveson inquiry, and certainly in Number 10 we were very interested in what was going on in DCMS at that stage. But since then something very significant has changed, which is that it has added a D to DCMS. So not only are we responsible for culture, media and sport, I think most people are familiar with DCMS responsibility for that, but we also have responsibility for digital, and digital combined with the creative industries, which are one of the huge growth industries in this country, actually alongside digital and the wider media landscape where we are world leading, means that DCMS is now a major economic department. We're responsible for about 14% of the economy, and I'm quite sure that in the coming years that will rise rapidly because of our responsibility for these very high growth sectors. So if it was ever the Ministry of Fun of David Mellor days, it certainly hasn't been that much fun in the past year, although I'm determined that we have more fun in the next year, but it is also economically significant. And my priorities are really focused around that. So there's three things that preoccupy my time. The first is tech and driving the digital revolution. We are at the forefront of digital industries in DCMS, and we've seen during this crisis how it's kept the economy going, how this kind of conversation, none of us would have dreamt of doing 2 years ago. A few very technologically literate people would do it, but the rest of us would have balked at it. Would have said this is only valid if we were all sat in a panel, probably in your plush offices at Teneo. And so we feel perfectly comfortable having a conversation like this, and we have feel comfortably comfortable having numerous business meetings, conferences, and so on. And that has kept the economy going. I think in turn, that has led to a step change in the potential for the digital economy in the UK and around the world. And I'm determined that as a digital secretary, we exploit that and we use it to the advantage of people in this country to create high quality jobs and growth. And the first thing we can do to ensure that is to drive the underlying infrastructure. So this conversation now is taking place probably for most of you using super fast broadband. That's a bit like building the road to your house, which is very useful. The technologies of today, you can do most of the things you want to do. You can download Netflix and Channel 4 on demand, or 4 and all the other excellent services that are available. But what we want to do is to build the motorway to your house, which will enable you to download 100 Netflixes at once. Now, maybe people don't need that right now, but they will need it as we move to the Internet of Things and we move to increasing digital integration. And just as the Victorians built sewers that were capable of serving the needs not of the 19th century, but of the 21st century, and we still use them in London, we need to take a similar approach to digital infrastructure. And that's why we've scaled up from about 9% gigabit coverage when we first Boris Johnson first became Prime Minister. We're at 40% now, be 60% at the end of this. So we're building the underlying infrastructure. Having built that infrastructure, we need to drive the growth. And I think particularly for our levelling up agenda, there is a huge opportunity. Suddenly, places that were not economically viable before have become economically viable. Even if it's just the commuter zone around major cities expanding enormously, because people can work from home a few days a week, commute in a few days, it means that you can work at a greater distance if you've got the reliable infrastructure, which we are building. But I also want to make sure we can continue to innovate off the back of that. That's why I'll be publishing plans for a new data approach. That means that having left the European Union, we're able to take advantage of data in a way that can drive growth and opportunity and the better public sector outcomes, as well, better outcomes for our public services, whilst at the same time ensuring trust in data. Equally, I'm determined that we drive competition in the tech sector. I think that if you look back to what the United States did at the turn of the 20th century, they understood that in order to continue to be able to benefit from new and emergent technology, you have to drive competition there. And that's why, for example, we set up a digital markets unit in the Competition and Markets Authority. Likewise, we're making sure that we protect people online with our online harms legislation. So there's a very exciting agenda there, which is unashamedly pro-tech, unashamedly driving growth and opportunity, but at the same time, making sure that we provide protection for our citizens. The second big priority, and one that has commanded most of the public's attention, is how we, first of all, protect what we love. So whether that is our great cultural institutions, our museums, our art galleries, or indeed our football and other great sports, government has been there during this COVID crisis. The £2 billion Culture Recovery Fund, the biggest single investment in arts in the history of this country and probably in the world, particularly when you combine it with all the other interventions, furlough and so on. We've put that support in. My next priority has been reopening. And we are making very good progress. So the good news is that we've got to step three. We've got the vaccine rolling out at pace, and I think you'll see the vaccine roll out quicker over the next few weeks. But we are in a race with the virus at the same time. So whilst we've got to stage three, and that means that we can do a lot of what we love, it's not the same going to, as I went to the English National Ballet on Monday, to a half-empty house. But more importantly, for those institutions and for every theatre up and down the country, they can't operate properly until we remove social distancing. Equally, our sports stadiums cannot operate profitably until they are full again. So I have a laser-like focus on getting to stage four of the roadmap, where we remove those remaining restrictions. The good news is that the vaccine is susceptible to the Indian variants. It works against the Indian variants, and every day the evidence gets better on that front. The bad news is that the Indian variant spreads more rapidly than other variants. So we just need to be sure before we move to stage four of the roadmap that we are just sufficiently ahead with the vaccination that we can cope with a rapidly spreading Indian variant. We just need to be sure about the speed of that spread. And there are some worrying signs in places like Bolton and Blackburn at the speed. It's not quite worrying enough to put us off course for the 21st, but it's not quite unworrying enough to be absolutely sure we'll get there. I hope in the next 10 days we'll get greater clarity on that and we'll be able to set out the next steps for that. And then once we're confident in the public health grounds through the events research program that I've piloted through our department, it really is, and we're the only country in the world that have done this to quite the same extent, covering so many different venues, really building an evidence base. I'm confident that we have the evidence base to put in the mitigations to enable that reopening to happen in a safe way. It's just the wider public health backdrop we have to be sure on. And then once we get things reopened, and we will get them reopened, I've no doubt about that. The only question is on the timing. I then want to make sure we get back to where we were in 2019, where we're on the cusp of really driving forward the creative industries. We are genuinely a creative industry superpower, and I want to make sure that we continue to build in this wonderful and unique microcosm we have in the UK. All of the things fit together, whether it's our wonderful world-class institutions like the V&A, where I was last night seeing the Raphael rooms and the Epic Iran. Very few other countries in the world could put something on like that and countless institutions do it. Our broadcasters remain the envy of the world. Our film industry is going stronger than it ever gone. Actually, the last quarter was the second strongest quarter ever, notwithstanding COVID, thanks to things like the reinsurance scheme that we've introduced, a £500 million reinsurance scheme. West End Theatre leads the world alongside New York. So all the pieces are there. They're the sort of jobs that I would want to do. I want my children, grandchildren, do, and I'm determined that we create those wonderful jobs of the future. And then finally, I'm not shy, as you may have seen, of the C in the DCMS brief. I do think it's important that we stand up for our cultural values as a nation. That's why I didn't hesitate when the proposals for the European Super League, which I really think went contrary to the best cultural traditions of our country, whereby our football clubs aren't some sort of transferable brand in the way that an American football club are. They have deep roots in their community. They're responsible for numerous charitable initiatives. They pull in their community. They train people. And there's huge, deep local pride in them. We should be standing up to them just as we should be defending our heritage and other institutions. I think that is a very important part of my role as culture secretary in an area that is of increasing interest for people, and I think will grow over the coming months and years. So hopefully that has given you a bit of a sense of what's in my in tray, but I'm very happy to take questions on that or anything else anyone would like to raise. Back over to you, Craig.
That's fascinating. Thanks, Oliver. There's loads in there for Alex, James and Dawn to react to. I want to give them each a sort of 2 or 3 minutes to respond and say where they are in their different sectors. So, Alex, why don't we start with you? In the last year, there was a sort of moment where we thought we might run out of TV. And then there were huge amounts of pressure on advertising. Where is the TV industry now, and what do you want to see going forward?
Well, we had a very peculiar situation, didn't we? So revenue and advertisers disappeared. We were all stuck inside, desperate for things to watch. And we had the problem that we couldn't produce things. You know, producing television involves lots of people being together, often in very close proximity. So that was complicated. I mean, we came through the revenue piece, and DCMS were very supportive of that. And actually, you know, we thought we might end up last year with revenues 20% down. We're wholly reliant on advertising. In the end, it was actually only about 5%. So advertising came back into the market, and it's really flooding back in now, which is good, you know, and I predict that will go up and up. So that's very positive. We did a peculiar thing in Channel 4. we cut a load of costs out, but then we put money back in to make responsive programming. So we did lots of things with like Jamie Oliver, Trapped at Home Cooking, and Grace and Perry making art at home, and all kinds of things in our lockdown academy. And we found we were really successful with that. So what we found was the British public wanted to see the situation that we were in as a nation reflected on screen. And it points a bit to what the Secretary of State has said there about culture being a unifying thing in this country. You know, we became more popular than we have in years, both digitally and in linear television, because we focused on that responsiveness. And that is something to do with how the British public see broadcasting here and what it brings them, which is very different to what they get from Netflix or Amazon. And there is a difference, not just of things that are done with a British perspective, but things that are done for sort of public service and come from this country. And the people find across the UK, wherever they come from, you know, what Scottish viewers want is very different to others, but that they find there's a unifying effect of that. And maybe we'll dig into this a little bit, but that's very different from social media, which tends to reflect views that are extremely different. And when you tune into it, you only get the one set of views that you're interested in. So they tend to be the opposite of unifying. So we found that that brought us great benefit last year. There was obviously all the stuff we did with campaigns about protect yourself, what you should do to stay at home, where we found that we could reach particularly young men and other groups that people couldn't. Found people watched a lot of news, so that was valuable. And then maybe the really interesting thing is to pick up on the point about technology is what it's allowed us to do as an organization. So we've, you know, moved to Leeds and Glasgow and Bristol, and we already had a Manchester office. We're now distributed much more across the UK. Got about 250 people in Leeds. We open our big offices there in a few months. We'll start broadcasting the national news from Leeds as well. But now, because of what we've talked about with technology and fast broadband, we're opening to all our staff. Would you like to move office? You know, where would you like to be? Where would you like your home office to be? And I think there'll be a radical shift in the UK, not just because of the splits there have been in people's views of Brexit, not Brexit, like was touched upon there, but because people have realized they can run their career from any place in the UK now. There's not such a London effect. And that is really important for organizations like us. That means we can get much broader perspectives from the people who work in the organization. And that's, you know, part of our whole move to the nations and regions, but something that we can now accelerate upon as an organization because we'd already begun and technology allows us to do it more.
Thanks, Alex. That was fascinating. James, I talking to you early on and following you on social media, I could feel your pain, theatre, being in real trouble early on. And also, I think a lot of your writing is about culture per se and splits that are maybe in the country, that kind of thing. Give us your take on where we are now.
Well, yeah, very thankfully, courtesy of the Culture Recovery Fund that was announced over the summer, we are in the position which is just giddy with excitement. Basically, a week ago, many West End theatres and theatres across the country began to reopen, which they hadn't sort of really done consistently for nearly a year. And as the Secretary of State will know more than anyone else, as he took testimony from people like me and playwrights and directors and actors and musicians and all the unforgotten heroes of the live arts, like costume designers and ushers and bartenders. It's it was never the case that theatre was special or required, the live arts required a different kind of a focus because of some sort of misplaced glamour. It's just that whilst every sector, whilst every industry was affected by the pandemic, for obvious reasons, theatre and what makes the live arts special is the thing that you cannot do in a virus, which is what makes it special. Unlike watching a Star Wars movie on your phone, is the physical proximity in a space, sharing the same air as the other audience members and as the musicians, dancers and actors. They just couldn't do it. We just could not survive. And unlike other business models, which could adapt to working from home, you cannot order a Royal Shakespeare play to your door on Deliveroo. Although actually, because of the circumstances, a lot of theatres did pivot and reinvent towards digital theatre, making short form work, or like the National Theatre did, putting archive on screen so it could be shared to people across the country for free. So yes, it's been incredibly tough. The Cultural Recovery Fund, because of its scale, because of how I have to say how it was distributed across the country, not just in London, it did save jobs. I'm an associate artist at the Nottingham Playhouse, and I can speak to the gratitude of that particular theatre. A lot of jobs, resident artists were saved and are now able to open further down the line and start producing work. Where it's been less easy to work through a solution is the freelancers. The majority of people who work in the arts are freelance, around 200,000. Because the money understandably went to theatre companies and buildings, it's now incumbent upon those theatre companies to start producing work and employing people again so that those freelancers can get back into employment. But we have lost people, like every sector, tens of thousands of people probably weren't able to sustain themselves through that period, which comes to, I think, the next challenge as we now open, and it's really exciting, and start inviting audiences back into the space. It's a question, and it's almost to the C that that Oliver mentioned, the culture element of this, and who gets to tell their story, who gets to hold the microphone, who gets a voice in the platform. And I think just that's one of the natural challenges that will come in the next year. I think the people, the artists most affected by this pandemic will be those from lower socioeconomic backgrounds, from minority ethnic backgrounds, and from regions and class backgrounds outside of urban city centres. They're most likely not to have survived in their freelance role. That's how we can protect and get those voices back so that we can have many different stories told. And just finally, on the point that sort of both Alex and Oliver made, it was actually, I don't know if the Secretary of State agrees with this, but I suppose one of the things I found optimistic and hopeful about having to make that case for why fund the live arts in this country at a time of entering great economic difficulty. And I actually assumed that the case is going to be very hard to make, very unpopular, that social media and the comment threads on websites would be not hugely supportive of this level of funding going into the live arts. I can't speak to what the Secretary of State's Twitter feed was like that morning, but from my personal point of view, it was really emboldening and encouraging that actually people across the country and outside of London, in Plymouth and in Southampton and in Edinburgh, they really, 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 really did not want their local theatre to close. And they found huge values, I'm sure we all did, including the people watching this, in lockdown, reminded us of the value of entertainment and art, spiritually, emotionally, psychologically, as well as all the economic arguments, which are vital. What storytelling did to all of us, I think, as a nation during lockdown was vital in unifying us, in getting us through it. And I'm hopeful going forward, actually, that there is a more tolerant and open and excited viewpoint that the culture sector can matter to normal people, particularly outside of city centres, because of being reminded of what storytelling and art has a value to us personally during lockdown.
So just quickly, Oliver, because I want to get to Dawn, I'll put it slightly more bluntly than James. A lot of people were surprised that the Conservative Party, which is often accused of philistinism, was giving £2 billion. Just a quick answer on that.
Well, I never had you down as a philistine, Craig. So you were comfortable working for the Conservative Party, and actually, actually, if you look, and I make this point repeatedly, what are the three, actually, in fairness, I shall say entirely objectively, the four biggest moments in the arts post-war? I think one was the aptly governed and the creation of the Arts Council England. I think after that, it was John Major creating the National Lottery and funding the renewal of our arts institutes. Many of them were looking pretty threadbare by the early 90s, and that put them on, had a sustainable funding that sort of stood aside from the ups and downs of government funding. Then George Osborne introduced tax credit reforms, particularly for the film industry, which helped transform it. I think that this intervention stands alongside those four in ensuring that we didn't lose our great cultural institutions during this crisis. And I do think in years to come, it will be viewed as significant as those other interventions. When it comes to James's point about my Twitter thread, I'm afraid I've long ago given up reading below the line. Therein lies the route to madness for politicians. But people in my special advisors occasionally let me know if there's a major campaign going on so we can react to it.
I can tell you it's pretty bad, Oliver. Dawn, can I just come to you? This has been a year where sport, there's real fears about it, but we've also seen like women's sport driving ahead and doing incredibly well. Can you give us your quick take on where you think we are with sport?
Sure, I will. But before, if I can sort of just take this opportunity just to pick up on something and then sort of the opening comments of Oliver and then James, because I am chair of the National Youth Theatre as well. And to be honest, the National Youth Theatre was a massive beneficiary of the recovery fund, for which enormous thanks. But it allowed us actually to rethink what we did and how we did it. And we had a sort of hybrid approach of both online and of still a physical presence. And we managed to produce and have a level of engagement that we've never had before. And it has allowed us to reset our agenda, which I think is, we're ahead of many cultural institutions who, to be honest, took the furlough money and fell asleep. Our youth organisation used it as an opportunity to extend its outreach and realise that actually theatre will end up online, and what happens online may well end up in the theatre. But there's this absolute fusion and hybrid that's happening in the theatre, which I think is a great cultural explosion and opportunity, and it addresses, James, some of the concerns that I know you have, and indeed National Youth Theatre have, around being able to physically get somewhere to experience, to have a theatrical experience. You don't necessarily need to be physically there in person. Anyway, you asked me the question about sport and women's sport. And again, thank you where thank yous are due, which is the Winter Sport Recovery Fund, which enabled the national game to continue, and the women's professional game to continue, was critical. And the women's professional leagues in the country, so there's the Super League and the Championship League, the assumption is, well, these are attached to Premier League clubs, so they've got oodles of money. But the reality is, of those 23 professional clubs, only 13 are associated are part of the Premier League, and they all have to run a separate P&L. So the women's game is very, very, very much funded at the lower end. And we only managed to complete the season because we had money to facilitate COVID testing. But you've acknowledged that, and it's happened, that there's been a change in perception, particularly of women's football. And I think that coincided with the 2019 World Cup, and particularly how well the Lionesses did. And when that last game, that semi-final, which alas, that we lost against the US, attracted just over 12 million viewers. I think there was a recognition that actually the sport had come of age, that women playing football is a different type of game, but actually they are supreme athletes. This is a fantastic piece of entertainment. And the FA has invested in women's and girls football for as long as you can remember. But we're just hitting now this turning point of this is a major a sport and opportunity for women and girls. And one of the challenges is that every little boy plays football, but in schools it's not available for little girls. And so what's the issue? Well, it needs to be part of the PE curriculum. So it needs to be part of the curriculum. Also it needs really good resources. And one of the great things that the Conservative government committed to in 2019 was an investment in grassroots football. Thank you, Oliver. You committed, I think, 550 million. We're seeing 25 million of that this year. We're looking forward to receiving the rest of it. Now, what is that grassroots money for? It's really important. It's for improving the facilities, because 40 million people play football, but they play football on substandard pitches. One in three pitches are not fit for purpose, and 150,000 patches a year are cancelled, which is really significant. And the investment in grassroots football allows boys and girls and men and women to play football, but it also is going to allow money to be spent in those regions that we talked about earlier that need to level up. So 40% of that money will be spent in 20% of the most deprived parts of the country, so fills, you know, multiple purposes. And the reason why the FA are so committed to developing the pathway for women and girls to play football is because a fit nation, as we all know, has immense benefits, both immense physical benefits, less pressure on the NHS because you have fitter, fitter population. But it's also really good for leadership. It has, and it's also fantastic for the investment that is made in local communities, because football contributes 10 billion of income into regions where there are football teams, in terms of direct employment, in terms of ancillary employment, all the, you think about match day, all of the activity, financial activity around that. And so football is, women's football in particular, is in the ascendancy, but it's an absolute crucial part of the nation also feeling good about itself. You know, we want to win. We want to win national, international, global competitions. And that money that the government have earmarked for grassroots football, let's be very clear, we've got a World Cup coming in 2030, and we want to win it. And it's about time that we did win it. But it'd be nice to win the women's World Cup as well. And we're very, very focused on that. So investment in facilities, grassroots facilities, is absolutely critical for the continuing rise of the women's game. And there's a huge amount of social benefit that goes with it as well. So
thanks, Dawn, that was great. There's a huge amount, there's already loads of questions coming in, lots to talk about, so I'm going to ask us to sort of like crack through some of these things. But I'm going to start on a big topic. We're coming up to the June 21st. It looks pretty good for us at properly fully opening up, although Oliver says that there are a couple of concerns still. People are wondering what is going to stay the same. What are we going to keep from lockdown that we wouldn't necessarily have if we hadn't had that? So it just short answers from all of you would be really interesting. So Alex, what do you think is going to stay the same?
Well, I'm hoping people will keep watching telly. I think they will. I think people will rebalance their lives slightly. So what you can see from consumers on the positive is they want positive, feel-good, celebratory programming. They also want more connection to nature. They also want to kind of rethink their lives. So the hideous being locked up, it has been dreadful, but the positive of it is that people are thinking, can they live in different places? Can they connect to nature more? Can they change their fitness levels, as Dawn mentioned there? So I hope that the positive is people will see their ways to adjusting their lives in order to fulfill those things.
James?
I think in the live arts, the obvious one to say is digital, the remote access to work for audiences who may not be able to get into the town or city centre, certainly who may not be able to travel from Doncaster to London to watch a famous actor in a big flashy show. What was really revelatory about the experience of sharing work in lockdown actually was that when you think, well, what do you know, you can watch any show, American television drama you want on Netflix at the touch of a button. You can download any movie to a portable device and watch it in your bedroom. So what is theatre's superpower? What is its weapon? And surely can we compete by just projecting a play onto a screen in the same experience that you would watch a Marvel movie? What was amazingly revelatory is that you can replicate the live experience of theatre and making it an event, even if you're just watching it remotely. So the majority of plays that were captured digitally still had a start time, 7:30, so that's turn up. You could make yourself a little cocktail in advance. Some people did sort of dress up. But what makes that special and what's important, and Alex sort of spoke about this in terms of the what is unifying about culture, is that you can still replicate that sense of sharing and watching something collectively at the same time as other people, rather than going to your own corner of the internet and falling down a rabbit hole there. You are watching something live with other people across the country at the same time, and it's an event. It's a unifying collective experience, which I think has a huge human value. So we can replicate that, but we've been forced to find that invention because of lockdown. And I think you'll see that continuing forward still.
Oliver, what do you think changed during lockdown that we'll keep?
I think three things. I completely agree, by the way, with what James said about the integration between arts and digital. And we see that in different spaces. So theatres, I think, are reaching new audiences, particularly young audiences. I'm hopeful that they will be and then be able to build on that and bring kids and people from all backgrounds who've not been into the theatre before, it gives them a route in. I said as well, I was very fortunate that my route into the theatre was my school, my Watford Comprehensive. We got in the minibus every Thursday and went up to see a show, and that built a lifetime love of it. And you see it also with galleries, actually. I think lots of people have been exploring works online. I hope they will go into galleries, because I think a lot of our cultural institutions have historically been slightly skewed towards an older age group, and I hope that this will provide a route in. I certainly think that people will have mixed working patterns. I don't believe the idea that people are going to continue to work like this the whole time. I think we thrive on human interaction, but I think the ability to have some days working from home, some days in the office, will mean that we have much more flexible patterns, which hopefully will mean people can have a better work-life balance. I certainly think it will see that our office space is shrinking and so on, and becoming more flexible, maybe located in multiple sites around the country in the way that Alex described. And one specific thing, I don't think hospitals will ever be the same again. I think the sort of what we have seen in terms of the disease control and the effect that has across the board, the COVID restrictions, masks and so on, I would bet that a lot of that will remain in perpetuity now, because we have seen how effective it is in preventing wider disease control in hospitals.
Dawn?
Yeah, I mean, I think surprisingly, I mean, football, and Alex can affirm this because you get the ratings, live sport has, in terms of a viewing experience on the telly, the ratings have remained very robust. In fact, probably some of them are all-time high ratings, not surprisingly, because you can't get to a match in person. So, I mean, sort of as we, I say, approach the end of the month, and the idea that as a footballer, you can play in front of a live audience, I think we're going to see an almost overwhelming demand for live experience. And I'm hoping that that's going to spin into the women's game as well, which comes back to why we need just consistently better facilities. It would be great to be able to, I mean, I never thought it would work, but it did. When I watched my first football match with dubbed crowds at Sky, but it actually ended up working remarkably well. But we're just looking forward to getting back to, you know, full stadium, and as Alex and James have said, you know, we all crave the human experience of community and collective experience, and there's nothing like football that best personifies that, or indeed any live sport.
So one other big theme before we get to some very specific questions was that the two very different things: what happened with the Super League rebellion, and then what happened with Black Lives Matter after the murder of George Floyd. But the thing that they had in common was that there was a massive public response that was organised digitally and went all around the world and had a huge impact. I'm just interested in hearing sort of reflections on the reality of that, and that being here to stay, and how you think that might sort of change things as well. So Oliver.
Yeah, I mean, I think we've seen this before, actually, with social media. It's transformed the way people relate to one another, and has meant that people that are living in disparate locations can form groups and collective action in a way that they would have taken years. Formation of political parties, campaign groups and so on can happen in literally minutes, and that has the ability to drive rapid and profound change. And I'm quite sure that we would not have seen the speed of withdrawal in relation to the European Super League were it not for social media showing clearly what people's views were rapidly. I mean, I'm very proud that as a government we stood very firmly behind the fans and reacted quickly, but you saw a whole nation coming together. That there's a speed there, and we saw that with Black Lives Matter as well. I think, though, the flip side of that is it does create challenges, which are that there's a danger to policy making around having too short an attention span and feeling that one has to react to absolutely everything immediately. And you feel this particularly as a politician, you know, you've got to immediately respond on Twitter or whatever else. It is important that we properly evaluate challenges and issues and decide what the appropriate response is, which is part of the point that I've been making in relation to contested heritage, which is that you know, it is a valid voice if people have a Twitter campaign against. There are equally millions of people that don't get on Twitter who also pay for those institutions through their taxes, and you know, their values need to be reflected in those organisations as well. So I think it's important that the leadership of those institutions have robust independence so that they can take long-term decisions, not feeling that something must be done. And I think sometimes social media can drive to the something must be done rather too quickly, rather than taking the time to pause and reflect.
So Alex, you're running a big television station. Are you noticing that this is shifting how you have to react and think and take editorial decisions?
I couldn't back up more the fact that taking decisions based on what people say on Twitter is a short road to doing the wrong thing. I think there's sort of something in what you're saying that plays to the last point, right, which is about people are seeking, coming through this pandemic and coming through some of the other things you've mentioned, they're seeking questions about what culture and what we all do can unify us, bring us together, but they are not seeking for us all to be the same, right? They are seeking simultaneity in when we do things, but not exactly the same moment. We are overwhelmed by choice, but we want to be with others as we do things. And those things sort of come together. You know, when you talk about sort of representing British cultural references, which is something, you know, we really do compared to, say, an SPOD, that doesn't mean being parochial. You know, often that sort of sense of being British is about accepting difference and being unified by difference. And there is an expectation from the audience and in how the audience reacted to Black Lives Matter that we will do that with a British take on it, right? Which is often taking into account our heritage and differences in terms of how we've come together as nations. But what they want is acceptance of difference, discussion of it, and they want some authenticity about that. And that the way we do that is very, very, the way we do it, the way the BBC do it, is very different to the way Netflix or Amazon would do it. And we've got to get that balance of what it is to be British and not assume that that means parochial, because often it's a British perspective on the rest of the world and on how we look at issues. And I think that's changed a bit with the pandemic as well.
James, some of the plays that you write are actually considered incredibly reactive for the medium. You know, within a year you have stuff out. Is it changing the way that you're writing things, or is it actually you're just going to continue the way that you are?
I think it's probably going the opposite way. I mean, to me, a play or a television drama or a film about real world events is the absolute antithesis to a tweet. A tweet is responsive and emotional and immediate. The joy of a play or a television drama is you get to take a breath, you get to step back, and you get to frame events in a way that invites lots of people into a subject matter in a way that I hope is slightly more nuanced, slightly calmer, and more considered. It's a cliche, forgive me for being romantic, but I believe that theatres are empathy factories, and there is an empathy deficit in most of the modern platforms and digital squares where we have these conversations. And that's why, to me, storytelling is so important. There's a different side to that. I mean, actually, and you mentioned it, I mean, I'm sometimes criticised for being too nice, can you believe it, to politicians, and even to you, Craig, when I put you in a television drama opposite. Which for Alex's own television channel, Brexit, the Uncivil War, with the prequel to this morning's events. You know, for me, the purpose of that was to write a television drama that both Remain voters and Leave voters could gather in a space, hear someone else's point of view and have their point of view represented. Some of the events you spoke about at the beginning of your question, Craig, Black Lives Matter and the Super League, to me, that comes from a place of powerlessness and lacking a voice. People felt powerless over their club. Black Lives Matter didn't feel like their stories are being told. So again, that is the value of drama. However, just to play devil's advocate very briefly, I'm a softie, so I do think most of my television dramas and plays try to unify and create empathy for different points of view. There is a different tradition, and a very important tradition, particularly in British theatre, of provoking and saying uncomfortable things and presenting alternative views, particularly to the government's point of view, and holding truth to power. And that's always going to be a tension, particularly for institutions that are publicly funded and receive money from the state, how you can take that and be grateful for that, but fulfill your moral political role of sometimes presenting a story about your heritage, about your national story, that is deliberately trying to provoke a response or give an alternative point of view. And I think that is something we have to obviously protect as well.
Great. I'm just conscious of time. So, and there's quite a few questions that are coming in. So a lot of them are directed very closely to you, Oliver. So can we just, let's see if we can crack through some of them, and I'll bring in the panel where it's relevant to them. A few businesses, including McDonald's, are asking about advertising rules and whether there's going to be a big change, particularly on high fat, sugar and salt advertising restrictions. Will they be proportionate for businesses of all sizes at the time of huge economic stress?
Yes, is the short answer. So the Prime Minister has identified as a priority dealing with the obesity epidemic we face really in this country. And we've seen through COVID how that has left many people ill-equipped to deal with COVID. And we know the longer term challenges around diabetes and so on. One part of addressing that is addressing advertising of high fat, salt and sugar products to children in particular. I'm equally, though, conscious, particularly with the M of my brief as Secretary of State for Media, of the profound consequences if we get that wrong for the sustainability of media and their dependence on advertising revenues. So I've really done two things. First of all, we've been clear that we should have equality between online and broadcast. So it would be completely self-defeating if we simply applied these restrictions to broadcast media, because it would just accentuate a trend already of advertising from broadcast to digital. And then secondly, to make sure we do it in a proportionate way. So for example, an extreme a digital ban could include, and these options have been put to me, of having owned content being covered. So that would mean a cake shop in my village that put on its Facebook page, come and buy some of these freshly baked hot cross buns this Good Friday, wouldn't be able to put that up because it was promoting a high sugar product. Clearly that's ludicrous. So what we're trying to do is make sure it's not disproportionate in terms of sort of businesses it affects and the kind of advertising.
So quickly, Alex, are you worried about there being a ban on these kind of things? Will that have an impact on your advertising and cause problems for you?
It will have an impact on advertising. There are not many children watching television at the times when those adverts are on, and we're already under quite tight restrictions. Having said that, nobody wants childhood obesity. You know, we're all against that. That's the correct thing for the nation. So it's a balanced thing. And we want to make sure that if a government does introduce this, it is balanced across all platforms, which Secretary of State's spoken about. I think we have to be careful not to create an unintended consequence that small and medium enterprises tend to be more on online platforms than they are on television. So I think there is significant work to do to make sure that we don't end up with an unintended imbalance, although I would hate to the hot cross buns banned from Oliver's High Street. I just think we've got to make sure that we balance that right, because there could be an unintended that small and medium businesses are online already and not affected. So there's work to do there, I would say.
Question from Google and YouTube, Oliver. They say they've been working really productively with the NHS and DHSC to tackle vaccine hesitancy, especially among the young. What lessons do you think we can learn on media literacy on the effectiveness of vaccine uptake? When can we expect the next iteration of the media literacy strategy?
Well, taking the second first, the media literacy strategy will be later this year. I think actually it's been one of the, and I don't want to jinx it by saying before the vaccine rollout is complete, but I think it has been one of the untold success stories. At the beginning of the vaccine rollout program, I was very worried indeed that we'd have a lot of misinformation and disinformation would encourage vaccine hesitancy. And we've worked very closely with Google, YouTube and other social media companies very constructively to address that. And that hasn't actually transpired. And we have some of the highest vaccine take-up rates in the world. And I think that has been a positive example of us working together.
Facebook are asking, how will the government ensure tech regulation, including around the online harms and encryption, helps keep people safe without making it harder for tech companies to want to invest and do business in the UK?
Well, first of all, on regulation overall, I am acutely conscious that we are asking tech companies to do lots of different things. So we have the requirements in relation to the digital markets unit on competition. We're looking at data, although that should be a net positive for the jobs and growth. We are looking at online harms and so on. So first of all, I'm encouraging regulators to work more closely together. So we're making sure that the ICO, Ofcom and others are working closely together. Secondly, I will be bringing forward some an announcement shortly about how we will develop that working together between regulators with a cross regulator sort of action plan to make sure we address the sort of layering risk. I would though say on end-to-end encryption, the Home Secretary and I have very grave concerns about the proposals for end-to-end encryption on Facebook and the implications of that, particularly for child safety, which we've raised with Sheryl Sandberg and others, and continue to argue against it. We are seeking to engage and have had some engagement with Facebook about it, but it's really important we address that.
While we're on online harms, someone's asking, why has journalistic comment been exempted from the online harms bill? Doesn't this allow the tabloid media to be super spreaders of fake news?
Well, first of all, I believe in a free press. I think it's one of our great liberties in this nation that people have fought and died for it. And it's one of the fundamental tenets, along with parliamentary democracy and other things, that safeguard the quality of life that we have in this country. And I don't want to inadvertently restrict journalistic freedom. That's why we created this broad carve out. It is the case, though, that most platforms do have moderation policies, but fundamentally it's because I believe in a free press.
And one more key quickfire question, this time from DeepMind. We know your department is working on an AI strategy for this year. Where does that sit in your priorities at the moment, and what do you see as the key opportunities for the UK coming out of it?
Well, first of all, it's been very good to discuss and work with DeepMind on this. It is one of my priorities. When I was talking at the beginning, I couldn't list everything in the tech sector, but certainly the AI strategy is very much top of mind. And I think it's important for the UK that in these areas where we have an emergent ability, we have the potential to be a world leader in AI, that we maintain and enhance that position, because too often the UK has started off in a strong technological position and lost it over time. And it is fantastic, the investment that's happened in DeepMind. We want to make sure we have a rich ecosystem for AI in this country, but also we make sure that we as a government engage and address some of the challenges around AI to make sure that people have trust and confidence in it. But I think it's a great area for potential growth that I've talked a lot to the Prime Minister about, and actually fits in with things like our integrated review.
Okay, we're coming towards the end of the session, and I want to bring up something that is quite nebulous and a little bit contentious, but let's see how we get on with it. It's basically, in the past, we've sort of talked about having one culture, and we talk about countries having a culture, and we're quite sort of generic about it. But increasingly, it's clear that there are kind of at least two tribes. You know, some people sort of caricature it as woke and unwoke. And a lot of people worry, and a lot of the businesses on this call will be worried about the fact that, you know, how do you speak with unity to, you know, people who are very, very split, very, very divided. Some people sort of think that actually politicians have a vested interest in winding that up. So with all the different hats that you have on, I'm going to start with you, Dawn. What are your thoughts on that, and how do we actually make sure that there is a bit more unity?
It's a
huge question.
I don't even know where to begin. There's always difference. There always will be difference. I think there's got to be clearly a levelling up of opportunity. The government has recognised that. It's desperately dealing with it. And it's, you could argue politically, it's had some success, which is why it romped home with the majority it had through appealing to sectors of the population that hadn't previously voted Tory. For me, it comes back to some pretty basic things, which is education, and a really key part of education is access to information. So what Oliver was saying earlier about the government fixated on, I think the government has to be fixated on getting those, like you say, super highways into everybody's home, whether you can afford it or not. So having true connectivity to everybody and giving individuals the access to access that connectivity that might be passing them, even if they can't afford, even if they can't afford it. And I think that there's always going to be difference, but it's about having respectful difference and understanding those differences and being able to both tolerate and understand through education that it's perfectly acceptable to have. I say it's perfectly acceptable. It's not perfectly acceptable to have racism, discrimination. But there's a true appreciation that is underpinned by a quality of education as to why people come up, maybe have differing points of view.
James, you've written a lot about division and some people think it's sort of getting worse. What's your take on it?
I think it will get worse before it gets better. I think we're living in polarized time and that our social fabric is very frayed and there are these flashpoints culturally, politically, where we've often feel like we are moved to the extremes of the debates, and actually most people are more moderate and in the centre than we're forced sometimes to be. Obviously, I think culture and education, like Dawn said, has a real vital role in finding those unifying elements. And I think that there's two elements there which are challenge, but that arts can play a role in. One, I think, is this levelling up strategy and what we do with our town centres, what we do with our high streets. I would love to hear more connectivity between the arts and culture sector into those conversations, because given that department stores are closing and people are ordering food to their homes, you have to say what is our public and physical realm going to be made up of? And I think it should be a great deal of community art and music, comedy, light entertainment, cinemas. Those are what's going to draw people into our communities, where you see yourselves collectively as a physical community, which will generate more empathy and unification. And then just finally, secondly, I think there is a silent crisis happening in education with arts, drama, sort of plummeting out of use because it's not, obviously it's no longer part of the EBAC. And we're seeing a huge fall in uptake in art subjects in secondary schools. And I think if we're going to get those voices, particularly from, you know, communities like mine, a former red wall town, how we're going to empower people across racial and class divides to be able to tell their stories and have a voice and feel part of the culture and have a stake in it, education would seem to me to be a relatively easy but vital way to equalise and level up as well as everything else.
Alex?
Well, I think it's true to say that there has been a divide in the UK over recent years, and that the media has a part to play in that. You know, the broadcasters were all guilty of miscalling the result of the referendum. And when you can't, as broadcasters, predict the mood of the nation, it shows that you're not filled with people who are representing the nation. You know, so part of our moving to a national HQ in Leeds, which meant hiring lots and lots of people who don't live in London, who've never lived in London, who don't want to live in London, is about changing your perspective as an organisation. And it's only by doing that, by changing the decisions you make, the people who make those decisions and their point of view, that you can try and represent better. And you can't be a national broadcaster and not do that. So that's key for us. It does mean, to James's point earlier, you know, part of our role, if you want to better represent your audience across the UK, is thinking about how you represent those who are marginalised or those who are underrepresented. And it does mean thinking about how you create perspective and empathy, because what you don't want is a totally divided country, and you know that responsibility is on us as well.
So finally, Oliver, you had a lot of praise for supporting the arts and culture in the last year, but also a little bit of criticism thinking, are you actually soaking up some of this culture stuff? What would you say to that?
Well, I certainly wouldn't say I'm stoking it up, but I'll come on to that in a second. I think it was very interesting what everyone was saying, but I was particularly struck by what James was saying, and indeed what Alex was saying about the a referendum and how it was miscalled, and I miscalled it as well. And I think you and were in number 10 at the time. You miscalled it. We all did. We thought it was basically going to turn out all right. Why did we miscall it? We all come from originally different backgrounds. I think, I mean, I talked about my Watford comprehensive, James. I think you had a similar background in the north, but at the same time, we've converged around if we're honest, around some cultural norms. We now have quite a lot more in common with each other than sometimes with our own background. And that struck me when, during the referendum, actually, my mum, who until very recently still worked in the boots just outside my constituency, she said to me, well, I think you're wrong on this, because everyone that's walking into this boots is saying they're fed up with Europe and they're going to jolly well vote to, didn't quite say it jolly well, but they're going to vote to get out. And I think it's very important that our institutions reflect the whole nation. I'm genuinely a one nation conservative, and I think that one nation means making sure our institutions do represent all people, not just people that have the sort of common values and broad sense of sort of more metropolitan outlook. So I think if we want strong institutions, they do have to reflect all parts of the country. And I think there has been a tendency in recent years that there's active campaign organisations that purport to speak for the wider community that don't actually. They represent a relatively small section of the community, and then institutions feel they have to change their position in relation to them, which in turn takes them more out of touch with the whole nation. So I think it's really important that institutions represent the whole country. But at the same time, I think, as Alex said, that doesn't mean that it's going back to some sort of 1950s view of the world. That's not where Britain is now, but it's making sure that our institutions celebrate all the diversity of Britain as it is now. And I think you rightly talk about how the nation has changed, and it would be equally damaging if we preserve things in aspic. At the same time, I think we also do need to look at the economic opportunities in parts of the country where people have chosen not to leave but to remain, whether people can bring up their families, can live, can have satisfying jobs. And it has been the case in a lot of areas of the country that people have felt they have to leave and move to London or Manchester or whatever in order to pursue those opportunities. I think with the digital infrastructure revolutions, and we have a unique opportunity to create more opportunities outside of metropolitan areas. And I do think that culture plays an important part in that. And I think about somewhere very close to where I live and represent, St Albans. Lots of my constituents live just outside St Albans. Why is it a nice place? Why do businesses set up there? It's not just because it's quite close to London. It's because it's got a very nice cathedral. It's got some very nice old streets in it. It's got some good cultural institutions that people participate in. And it's that sense of wider sort of well-being that is generated from investment in those places and those cultural institutions that help enrich them. And I think, as part of Levelling Up, I'm certainly making the case with my cabinet colleagues that we have to make sure that we also invest in the wider sort of those cultural assets, whether it's town improving high streets or whether it's making sure that there's good cultural institutions. I was speaking to the new Conservative MP for Sedgefield, and he said, well, I can't access your cultural recovery fund because we don't have any institution that could benefit from it. Well, that is a major problem, and we need to make sure that as we look at Levelling Up, we don't just look at the internet and the broadband and the roads and the railway. We also look at the other things that make those places attractive places to live.
We're massively overrunning time, so I just want to say thank you to a great panel. We could end up talking about this for hours, but you've been a fantastic panel. Oliver Dowden, Dawn Airy, Alex Mann, James Graham, thank you. I want you to imagine that we're in one of James's plays and there's a virtual standing ovation going on at this moment for great contributions. Thank you very much, and we'll do another webinar soon. Thanks, everybody.